From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Republican Senator Ron Johnson talks about his lawsuit to block the Affordable Care Act and the need to overhaul the Veterans Administration.
We need to open up veterans' access to other health care facilities. What I'm really trying to get people to concentrate on is understand that if we continue down this path of Obamacare and we move more and more to just a government-run health care system, we've already got a model of how that doesn't work. It's called the VA system.
We'll learn about current trends in housing for millennials. And we'll also hear some Puerto Rican music that might be classical, it might be folk, but one thing's for certain.
This music was meant for a dance. And the actual root of it, it was just an orchestra playing this music, and people would come into the hall and dance this music.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Last week, the liberal watchdog group One Wisconsin Now filed a complaint against Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson. It claimed he was not being forthcoming in disclosing the money he's using in his own suit to try to block part of the Affordable Care Act. Johnson's suit has the support of around three dozen Republican federal lawmakers, though it has also been criticized by some in his own party as frivolous. Some 8 million Americans have enrolled for coverage under the Affordable Care Act, and a little more than a quarter of them are younger adults. Senator Ron Johnson spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke by phone from his Senate office, and he discussed the lawsuit and his reaction to the latest enrollment numbers.
The first reaction is we don't really know what the details are underlying those numbers. We really don't know how many of those 8 million people were previously uninsured. And, of course, that was the primary rationale. The main selling point of the health care law was to make sure that 30 to 40 million Americans who were previously uninsured would be insured. And so even 8 million, if they all were previously uninsured, were far past the goal. But it looks like there's a whole lot less percentage of those people that were previously uninsured. So, you know, Obamacare hasn't really fulfilled even its first purpose. And by the way, we didn't have to totally remake our insurance and our health care markets to try and address those individuals that didn't have access to care.
Well, what would you have rather seen done to address those issues? Because obviously, I think empirically speaking, there are a lot of Americans without health insurance.
Sure. You know, first of all, I agree with President Obama. No American should go bankrupt because they get ill. But there are ways of handling that. In the state of Wisconsin, we have the high-risk pool. I think if combined with what Obamacare already has, I mean, so many of these policies now are very high-deductible plans, previously referred to as catastrophic care plans. If you can combine a high-deductible major medical plan with high-risk pools, you can take care of pre-existing conditions. You can actually provide that as a social safety net. In other words, if you really can't afford health care, I think that's the social safety net, a high-deductible plan. That also, as long as you're carrying that, either whether you pay for it or whether it's subsidized by taxpayers for those who simply can't afford it, you also qualify for the high-risk coverage in case you get ill and the insurance company decides not to renew coverage. I mean, that's what ends up happening. So I think we certainly could have done this a smarter way. And then, you know, one advantage of high-deductible plans combined with things like health savings accounts, you actually start reintroducing the free market competitive system into our healthcare system. I mean, that's been largely removed because of our third-party payer system, whether it's through insurance or government healthcare like Medicare and Medicaid. And as a result, we've taken the free market disciplines of really driving costs down as low as they possibly can be, and quite honestly, increasing quality in customers and levels of customer service. So the free marketplace is a marvel. Competition really works, and unfortunately for decades, we've pretty well squeezed those free market benefits out of our healthcare system. We should be moving in that direction as opposed to we're moving the direction of a total government takeover of our healthcare system. And, you know, final note on that, we're looking at the scandal in the VA system, which is a government-run healthcare system. I mean, that's what's on our horizon if we don't get off this path of Obamacare.
We'll get to the VA system in just a moment, but I do also want to ask you, you have filed suit in federal court challenging a component of the Affordable Care Act that, if I understand correctly, allows lawmakers and their staffs who are enrolled in a particular plan to have their health insurance costs subsidized by the federal government. Why does that particular aspect of the ACA demand legal action, in your estimation?
Well, first of all, I have no problem employers contributing to their employee health care. I did it for 31 years, and I think the federal government ought to be able to do that as well. But the problem is Congress specifically visited that issue. Democrats in the Senate specifically voted against allowing the government to make a contribution into those exchange plans that members of Congress and their staff were forced to purchase. And as a result, that's the way the law is. And if Democrats, if the president doesn't like the law, they should come back to Congress and change the law. But that's not what President Obama has done in this instance or dozens of others. And so this is the main purpose of my lawsuit is to highlight and hopefully overturn a change in the law that President Obama has no legal or constitutional ability to do. He's simply not authorized to do this. There's nothing in the Constitution that allows the president to enact, amend, or repeal laws, and that's what he's doing. So that's really the main purpose of the lawsuit is to put a check on a president, on an executive that's out of control.
So you do not see this as about the cost of this policy that affects, I think, what, 12,000 workers?
Sure. Well, certainly it is also unequal treatment under the law. I mean, only members of Congress and their staff, when they lose their health care because of Obamacare, as millions of others have done, only members of Congress and their staff qualify or have their employers are allowed to make a pre-tax, a tax-preferred contribution into those exchange policies. That's just unfair. It's unequal treatment, and that should be addressed. But there's ways of addressing that as well. But again, it should be done constitutionally through the legislature by changing the law. But again, this president has changed the health care law dozens of times, and he really doesn't have the authority to do it. And you know, one of the amicus briefs that was filed and accepted by the court on this lawsuit pointed out that if you take the government and this president's argument or his actions to their logical conclusion, a future president could literally decrease everybody's taxes by 50%. I don't think any American believes a president has that authority on his own, but nobody could challenge him because nobody is being harmed by it. And that's really the only arguments, the government's case argument against my case is that I don't have standing. I haven't shown specific harm, but I'm trying to make the point that there is specific harm. But in addition, we're at a point of constitutional crisis. It is time for members of Congress to affirm their oath to uphold, support, and defend the Constitution, and it's well past time for the judiciary to get involved in this very important separation of powers issue.
Let me ask you one more question along those lines. There are some on the other side of the aisle who have criticized you for tying the lawsuit to your campaign fund. There's one group has filed a complaint with the FEC over the billing for legal work related to your suit. Why do you see it as appropriate to involve this as part of be able to fund this, that is, through your campaign fund?
Well, we went to, before I ever did this, I went to Senate Ethics, which is relatively rigorous process to find out if I initiated this lawsuit, how could I pay for it? Now, frequently these things are done with outside group, like 501c3, those types of group funding. The Senate Ethics Committee said, no, I couldn't do that. I could either pay for it personally or utilize campaign funds. Now, trust me, when you're trying to run for re-election, it's not that easy to raise money through your campaign. So I think Senate Ethics probably viewed that no one would be foolish enough to squander those very valuable campaign resources. But I felt this was such an important constitutional issue. Even if I wouldn't have been able to use campaign funds, I would have paid for it personally. So anyway, we've been very open with that disclosure. I announced that the day we filed the lawsuit. So this is a really frivolous complaint lodged against us, and what it shows me is that certainly people on the left are pretty concerned about really the landmark potential of this lawsuit. Because if this regulation is overturned, if the courts review this and say no, President Obama does not have legal authority to do this, that is going to put in question dozens of executive orders where President Obama is acting unilaterally.
The other issue that you mentioned and that's getting a lot of attention from people on both sides of the aisle is the difficulty veterans appear to be having receiving timely health care from the VA. What do you think the proper way to fix that situation is?
Well, first of all, we all need to recognize that we owe it to the finest among us, people who step up to defend our freedoms, to support them in their training while they're in the field and when they come home, you know, to the extent, as long as they need it. And so it is an outrage that the VA system has such an enormous backlog. And, you know, from my standpoint, I think what we need to do is we need to open up veterans' access to other healthcare facilities. You know, again, what I'm really trying to get people to concentrate on is understand that if we continue down this path of Obamacare and we move more and more to just a government-run healthcare system, we've already got a model of how that doesn't work. It's called the VA system. And so I don't know why anybody would want to put our entire healthcare system on the same footing or the same path as the VA system, but that's the direction we're going. What we ought to be doing is the VA system is put it more on the path of our private sector healthcare system, you know, whether it's some kind of premium support or whatever. We're going to have to come up with the right way of doing it. But you know, so, there's so many of these VA hospitals are so far removed from where the veterans actually live, and makes it extremely difficult for people to access care. Not to mention the fact that the system just is broken. It's just is not able to handle the number of people effectively. And I don't have a real good answer for you. When I visit VA centers in Wisconsin and one that serves Wisconsinites in Minnesota, you know, the people I'm talking to seem very concerned about care of veterans. They're looking for PTSD and PTSD symptoms. I think there's still, in many cases, a real high quality of care, and I think it's just the bureaucracy of a government system that's weighing it down.
There are some who would say that this was fated to happen, that as we wound down wars in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, without necessarily increasing the funding for VA health care for the people who are returning from those places, that we were just going to have this backlog. Do you believe the VA has enough resources to get the job done?
I don't have the figures at my disposal here, but you know, so much of the VA system really is dealing with, you know, people that are certainly more elderly than current vets. I mean, we're talking about Vietnam era vets, even some Korean vets. You know, there's still some World War II vets, and I think that's the problem. Really, is more in the more elderly population of veterans as opposed to the Iraq and Afghanistan. Although I'm not sure those folks are being properly served as well. But I think what's really overwhelming the system is just the aging of the veteran population.
You are two-thirds of the way through your term in office. How would you hope people view your time in the Senate thus far?
Well, I'm hoping people understand that the promises I made during my campaign, that I would never vote my reelection in mind, and that I'd always tell them the truth. I'm hoping people are recognizing the fact that I'm definitely honoring those promises. And you know, my primary mission really is to provide as much information, to provide the facts and figures, to hopefully get enough Americans to, first of all, acknowledge, you know, admit the severe financial problems we have in this nation, and then work with me to properly define them, to do some root cause analysis so that solutions that we propose will actually fix the problem. You know, Mitch, what I see here in Washington is an utterly dysfunctional federal government. Now, I don't have a great deal of faith that it can solve any problem. So, you know, my point is you're certainly not going to solve problems if you're not properly diagnosing the root cause of them. And so it really is the first couple steps in any problem-solving process is first admit you have one and then properly define it so that you're actually tailoring your solutions to address the root cause of the problem. You know, we just deal with symptoms around here all the time, and symptoms just kind of, you know, put a Band-Aid on the problem and oftentimes make it worse.
Senator Ron Johnson, thank you so much, and hope we'll talk to you again soon.
Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
Ron Johnson is a Republican senator from Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke by phone from his Senate office in Washington. Housing trends for the millennial generation. We'll hear about them next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Though the housing market across the country continues its slow rebound, the U.S. Census shows that fewer young adults are buying homes compared with just a decade ago. Milwaukee's millennials in the housing market seem to be following that trend, according to a report prepared by local real estate development company Wangard Partners. But CEO and founder Stu Wangard says it's not all bad news, and in fact, his company's study shows the young professionals of the millennial generation are having a big impact on Milwaukee's market. He tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce what he sees happening.
Milwaukee's going through a rebirth, and we predicted that just from studying demographics. Statistics and demographics are not always the most exciting thing to get into, but it tells you where the future is heading, and it gives you a pathway. And we saw that the young people, the millennials, really have a true passion for urban living. And Milwaukee is a city that they embrace. We anticipated that there'd be a big influx of people into the area. It's a much more passionate group than we've seen in years as far as wanting to make things change in this community.
Is this a reversal you're seeing from the generation before it with the millennials?
I don't think the generation before was quite as interested. There were plenty of people that came into the city as they consider themselves urban pioneers, even though there were plenty of urban pioneers before them. But they, as a generation, had children a little bit earlier, and so they moved out to the suburbs when they started raising their families. The millennial generation is larger than generations before that. They're delaying having children. Actually, their pets are probably more their children.
So with the millennials wanting to settle in the city, what is that doing to the real estate market downtown?
It's expanding the neighborhoods that are going through a rebirth right now. And we talk about the city of Milwaukee, but it's impacting all the urban areas, including the first ring urban areas. So it's impacting communities such as West Dallas, Sherwood, and Wauwatosa. Sherwood and Wauwatosa have probably received more of the benefit of that. And neighborhoods such as Bayview in the city of Milwaukee are going through a rebirth. The Fifth Ward is now becoming very, very popular. And the East Side has been popular and is stronger than ever before.
Now, what are we seeing with millennials when it comes to home ownership versus rentals? Do they have a preference?
It's not necessarily it's a preference. It's just it's the millennials are a much more highly educated population than generations before. And along with that, they're carrying a lot more student debt. Some of them also experienced, through their parents, they experienced the problems that occurred during the recession. And they saw the struggles that home ownership created for their parents and the amount of debt and the loss of equity. And yet there's a certain amount of the millennials that really want to own their own home. They want control of the future. And those that can, a portion of those are investing in our community. And they're willing to be much more flexible as far as what neighborhoods they'll go into.
Interesting. What do you mean by that?
They're looking for character in their neighborhoods. They're looking for amenities in their neighborhoods. And they're willing to go and take on a little bit more work. And I've had other people tell me, well, no, millennials want everything ready to go. They want that home that's ready to move in. It's painted. Everything's ready. No, you can't go and say millennials fit one specific category.
How have you seen the housing industry respond to some of these changing demands that the millennials are bringing to the market?
Coming up with smaller homes, richer in character. The millennials don't need the same amount of square footage, and they're not into stuff quite like the prior generation. So they're not looking for a lot of space for a lot of furniture.
That's an interesting contrast to the trend of the McMansions that were so popular just a few years ago, maybe 5-10 years ago.
A lot of people got in way deeper than they should have on the McMansions. Again, this is a group that is very much aware of the world around them.
So if you say that the majority of millennials in the housing market are renters at this point, some going for home ownership, the majority staying as renters, what kind of apartments are they looking for?
What we're putting together, and we've had a very good success with it, are amenity-rich apartments. And we talked earlier about pets being their children. So we do things like we put in dog washing stations for them. They're very interested in fitness. We have fitness centers for them. We have clubhouses for them and club rooms. And the purpose of the club room is to create a gathering spot for people within the building. We talked about millennials, and there's a lot of people that are moving into Milwaukee from throughout the world and from throughout the United States. It's a gathering spot. It's an area where they can go and meet new people. And within the units, we put all the bells and whistles in there. We put things like individual washers and dryers in each unit. These are big open spaces as far as their feeling, their look, but yet the square footage is somewhat limited. How do you do that? We bring in a lot of sunlight through big windows. Energy efficiency is very important to them. They are interested in sustainability. They are interested in improving not only their life, but the life of those around them.
Now, you're creating these developments. Do you see that the housing stock, the apartment stock in Milwaukee, generally meets the kinds of desires and demands that this population is looking for?
The new stuff, yes. The old stuff, no. I mean, the old buildings, a lot of them are drafty. We haven't seen a lot of new construction since the 70s. And prior to the crash, the 7 years prior to the crash, a lot of the new housing stock that was built was condominiums. And the condominiums were larger units, not necessarily the best use of space, but big units. And that doesn't meet the requirements of the people today.
Does the trend that so many right now are renting, does that hurt or help the housing market now? And could that change in the future?
We're seeing the housing market coming back, but it's still, the majority of the units are still for apartments. And yet the need or the type of apartments that people want are changing year to year. If you put up a building last year, you would have wanted to have all the units be one-bedroom apartments. Now we're seeing a number of two-bedroom units. And we see a trend that as people feel more confident about their jobs, they're becoming a little bit more confident about their relationships. While in some cases it's just doubling up with a roommate, in many cases it's somebody entering into a committed relationship. Warren Buffett was the one who said that the rebirth of the housing market, the single-family housing market, will come when people want to have children. And yet, the largest part of the millennial generation is currently in college. They're currently at the university.
So it's going to be years.
Correct. We should have a very strong housing market for 10 years. There will, of course, be some areas that will become oversaturated, but there'll be many other areas that will continue to be very dynamic and in demand for years to come.
Do you see a potential for oversaturation in Milwaukee?
Certain areas, yes, but I think it's temporary. On the east side, there's 500 units that will be coming on stream this summer, and we'll see some softening in that area. And yet, long term, it's an area that people want to live in, and we have other developers bringing in some nice amenities. We're seeing some new grocery stores opening up in the area, many new shops. And day after day, we see a lot of great new restaurants opening up throughout the metropolitan area, but mostly in the 5th Ward, Walker's Point, Bayview, and the East Side.
What do you look for? I mean, how do you predict where are going to be the popular areas when you're going to develop?
It's no secret. Anybody who studied our company knows that all of our developments to date have been within 4 blocks of a grocery store. If we're in a walkable neighborhood, a neighborhood with good public transportation, that's key to us. But we've taken another step further. We're working with Bid 21, Milwaukee County Transit, City of Milwaukee, DPW, and private contractors to augment what's already there with public transportation and try to add additional linkages. And we're working right now with the community that wants to put in new bike stations. So our developments are walkable, have good public transportation. It's still easy to get to the highway system. And we consider bicycles actually part of the transit solution.
What about affordable housing? How important is that to the millennials? And are you looking at locations in Milwaukee to develop where there's really a need for amenity-rich but affordable housing?
Affordability of housing is a concern, whether or not you're talking about single-family or multifamily housing. That's not the key part of our business, and yet we are very aware that not everybody can afford the luxury apartments that we have been building. And so we're partnering up with other established affordable housing providers. We've had meetings with other developers and then also with community advocates, and we're trying to find ways to address the affordable housing needs of the community. And we are trying to figure out how to come up with units that meet a much broader range of the market and of the community.
What have you seen change, even just in the last few years, as we've come out of this recession?
Well, one of the changes that's occurring right now is we're seeing the parents of the millennials also wanting to move into the city. We are seeing the boomers wanting to move back into the city also. And the thing that's surprising is how we're drawing people from all over the United States back in. With our units, almost 50% of them are being occupied by people that are new to Milwaukee.
How specifically are these trends when it comes to the millennials and what they're looking for in housing today? How is this economically beneficial for Milwaukee?
People have a tendency to put down roots. They're not just here and saying, this is a stopping over point. So the moment they put down roots, they're active in the community. They look for ways to improve the community. Of course, they're spending money here. Here's the shift that's occurring, and this is not just a millennial shift. It's not a Milwaukee shift. There is a goal and a movement to buy local. There's an interest in fresh foods. They're interested from farm to the table foods. Getting to know the people in the neighborhood. Those are trends that aren't short-term in nature.
And that applies even with such a large percentage of the millennials renting versus going for home ownership at this time?
Oh, it's across the whole spectrum. It's not an ownership versus a rental issue as far as commitment to the neighborhood. Of course, if somebody buys a home, that is a long-term commitment. And we're seeing this group being more mobile. As they've gone through school, they've had a chance to travel. In many cases, the school systems have also encouraged overseas studies. So the disadvantage is, yes, you have a group that's saying for the right job, they'll pick up and move on. And that discourages home ownership to some degree. The moment they get in a committed relationship, Milwaukee is a standout. It's a great place to raise a family.
So the market for single-family homes isn't really in danger that it's going to, you know, that we're going to have all this stock on the market that isn't being taken up by millennials, you think? It's just a matter of when that happens.
If you're going to talk about any danger in the housing market, Milwaukee has larger than normal share of foreclosed homes and homes that have been lost through tax foreclosures. Part of it's a bank foreclosure, part of it's a tax foreclosure issue. There's a number of people that purchased homes that probably should not have, and they've lost homes. Now, you also have a lot of young entrepreneurs who are going into the city, rehabbing the housing stock, and for them, it's not just about money. It's a mission. They're saying, we have a chance to change the neighborhoods, and we kind of feel the same way. I wish I could say our firm could do it by ourselves, but what we're asking them to do is work together as a group, concentrate their efforts in certain neighborhoods where they can rehab housing stock block by block rather than scattered. It's interior and exterior fix-ups. They're trying to make homes more energy efficient. When you start seeing people putting money into a neighborhood, you start seeing a lot of different groups take pride in the neighborhood. It has a huge transformation. But you're also bringing jobs into areas that need it and jobs that are within walking distance of the workforce. And that's the shift. You know, we've talked before about how Milwaukee is a car-centric community. Well, you want jobs near where the available workforce is. We have to work with other developers and other people in the development community. And as a group, we can have a huge impact on a neighborhood. And again, we talk to each other. We talk about what things we can do as far as adding to the area.
Where do you see the market going in the future, say in the next 10 years?
I think Milwaukee is going to be one of the most dynamic areas to live in. The Renaissance started along the river first. Milwaukee's not one of these flat desert towns. We have great views here. The school district is slowly improving. Looking forward to seeing who we have for a new superintendent. Groups like Milwaukee are trying to go and influence the change. And I think our elected officials are just starting to go and see how influential this group will become.
Well, Stu Wangard, thank you so much for coming in and kind of giving us this overview of the housing market here in the Milwaukee area.
Thanks, Stephanie. Good talking to you.
Stu Wangard is the chairman and CEO and founder of Wangard Partners, a real estate development company specializing in commercial and residential multifamily projects. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce. There are more options than ever on Milwaukee menus, but not necessarily for the youngest diners among us. We'll have one essayist's take when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Stay with us. We're back with more of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Yesterday on Lake Effect, we met Justin Abrahamian, the Beard Award-winning chef at Milwaukee's Sanford Restaurant. Across the city, diners have more great eating options than ever before. Well, at least most of them do. Lake Effect essayist Lane Pierce says the options for kids are sometimes more limited than she or her son would like.
It was a Wednesday afternoon when my phone beeped with a text from my husband that read, "Want to go out to eat tonight? Is the Pope Catholic?" A few times a month, we decide at the last minute that I don't want to cook, or he doesn't want to do the dishes, or we don't want to eat one of the meals that is in regular rotation at our house. So we go out. It's a treat, for us and for our 2-year-old son. We have our favorite haunts, some better than others. And on this particular night, we found ourselves at a neighborhood bar and grill that is kid-friendly, meaning they have a kid's menu. As we settled into our booth, stocked with crayons and coloring pages, swirly straws and sippy cups, I reviewed the menu design for little ones. Our options were, all with fries and a drink, grilled cheese, chicken tenders, cheeseburger, penne with butter or marinara, or fried cheese curds. That's right. Cheese curds as an entree. Maybe if you ordered the burger, you'd be lucky enough to get a bite or two of something green. Aside from the noodles, which he could eat army surplus style, my son doesn't really dig those kid-friendly options, and I'm not paying $6 for a meal comprised of noodles and fries. So we ordered 2 adult entrees for all 3 of us to share and asked for a side of their vegetables. "Oh, we're out of vegetables tonight," the waitress informed us, saying she just sold the last one. "What? So your restaurant is literally out of vegetables?" I asked. "Yes," she replied. I nodded, stupefied, as I pictured her reaching into a dusty barrel, pulling out the last raw turnip and putting it on a plate for the family next to us. By no means am I a food purist. At best, our family could be described as nutritionally confused. We eat our whole grain flaxseed waffles covered in syrup that's not really syrup, but high fructose corn syrup with caramel color. We make hot chocolate with organic milk. And we eat chicken sausage that doesn't really say there aren't nitrates. But cheese curds as a meal? A restaurant that runs out of vegetables? Even the nutritionally confused know there is something wrong with that. Why is it that professionals in the food industry expect so little out of their smallest patrons and said patrons' parents? Parents are given the choice of processed starch on the kids' menu for $6 or a full $18 entree that is delicious, nutritious, and 8 times the amount of food a small person wants to eat. I want to order my son 1 fish taco with a small side of Asian slaw. My kiddo would put it away. Or 1 slider with a side of veggies and a handful of fries. Down the hatch. The message children get from the kids' menu is, "Enjoy your food. Our expectations for you are low." Let me, though, share a sign of hope. Some restaurants have woken up to the fact that kids will eat more than buttered noodles, although that will always be an option on the kids' menu, of course. Later that month, we decided to navigate the rough restaurant terrain again. When ordering the kids' mac and cheese, we were asked by the server, "Would you like whole wheat noodles?" "Why, yes, we would," we replied enthusiastically. "Topped with edamame?" she asked. "Stop it," we shouted, flushed with excitement. One small step for dinner, one giant leap for children kind.
Lake Effect essayist Lane Pierce writes, wrangles, and raises a spirited toddler with her husband in Whitefish Bay. We'll take one last break and then have an in-studio performance in the guitar traditions of Puerto Rico. That's coming up when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Guitars have been around in one form or another for millennia, and they are an incredibly popular instrument all around the world. The way they are played, however, is what makes them unique. Spanish guitar music crossed the Atlantic Ocean with the conquistadors, and that influence can be heard in the guitar music throughout Latin America, including Puerto Rico. Hector Gonzalez and John Ruiz traveled from Puerto Rico to study the guitar at the Peck School of the Arts Fingerstyle Guitar Program. They came from opposite sides of the island and met each other for the first time when they began the program here. And although they studied classical guitar at UWM, they took it upon themselves to learn Puerto Rican guitar music on their own.
So Hector Torres Gonzalez and John Ruiz, welcome to WWM.
Cool. Thanks for having us here.
Can you just please tell us about that beautiful song you just played?
The name is Ten Piedad by the composer Juan Morel Campos. He's Puerto Rican, one of the most important composers in Puerto Rico, the classical music, and in English is No Mercy, right?
Have mercy.
Yeah, and it's very beautiful. It's very deep and very lovely.
Yeah, this composer is known to write very beautiful melodies. He was one of the most prolific 19th century composers in Puerto Rico. So, and especially in this genre of danza music. Mm-hmm.
So you keep mentioning Puerto Rico. You are from there then?
Yes.
Yeah,
we're okay. Both from Puerto Rico.
So how did you end up in cold Milwaukee?
Well, for example, me, you know, Puerto Rico, I've been in Puerto Rico 26 years in hot, very hot weather all the time. And I was like planning to have a cultural change, like leave cold and winter. And well, and I'm here loving it. Yeah, it's kind of cold, but I love it.
I guess this winter at least was a bit too much, too brutal. Last year was not that bad. Well, I'm here basically because of our teacher,
yeah,
Rene Izquierdo. We both came here to study with him, and I guess in that sense, it didn't matter where he was.
Yeah, that's true.
But I came here, got to the school, and actually, I love the city. I just fell in love with Milwaukee.
Yeah.
So you both are students from UW-Milwaukee, correct?
That's right.
So how did you learn about your professor? And do they know about Puerto Rican guitar music?
Yes, he definitely knows, especially because he's Cuban.
There you go.
But, well, I learned from him because as I was finishing my undergrad studies in Puerto Rico, one of my professors, who is a composer, he had written a guitar concerto, and Rene Izquierdo went to Puerto Rico to play it. And then everyone down there fell in love with his playing and him, you know, and my teacher told me, you got to go study with him. I mean, that's your goal. And I hadn't even met him. I talked to a lot of my friends, and I talked to him via email. And then I said, this is just who I'm looking for. You know,
in my situation, I never saw René Izquierdo because I live in the other side of the island. And Hector live in, we are very far in Puerto Rico. So it's very funny that we met here in Milwaukee. And so I knew about René when I went to the GFA festival in Texas, in Austin, Texas in 2010. Mm-hmm. And someone recommended me him for master, and I talked to him, and he was amazing. And I say, well, I'm going to Milwaukee.
So let's talk a little more about the Puerto Rican music. What makes Puerto Rican music? Like, what is his characteristics? And are you playing classical or are you playing folk Puerto Rican music?
That's a good question, actually, because it's like folk, but this classical music, you know, like...
Because it's very elegant music. Danza means like a dance in English. So this music was meant for a dance. And the actual root of it was just an orchestra playing this music, and people would come into the hall and dance this music. I think there's a general sense that it's classical music from Puerto Rico, as you would call like a waltz classical, mm-hmm. or you would call polka, maybe, yeah. Or in that sense. But, I mean, it's also folk music because it's
very
from Puerto Rico.
Cultural.
You know? The rhythms and the form of it is very Puerto Rican. And we can recognize it. Really
sometimes our professor tells us all the time is like, hey, you need to feel the music. You're Puerto Rican when we're playing the dance. So the dance have like a mix of European music, but with the thing of Puerto Rico, like the conga of the African music. So the composer like have that influence and he make the dance.
So then what's the difference between Puerto Rican classical guitar and Cuban or Spanish classical guitar?
The Cuban's music is a bit older than us. I mean, most people agree that this form of music came from Cuba. So the Cubans came to Puerto Rico and brought this dance, and then the Puerto Ricans, they change it and make them their own. You know, this is what is generally taught. Most of the rhythms are fairly familiar between Cuba and Puerto Rico. And Spanish, there is some harmonies and structure types that come from Spain, but it's totally different in the sense of what you're hearing from Spain. Maybe for us, because we're Puerto Rican and mm-hmm. we grew up with this and we know it, it's easier to distinguish that.
It's like, you can feel it.
Yeah. But, you know, in that sense, that's the main difference between just general Cuban music, Puerto Rican music.
Sure. I think it's also kind of, there's a parallel between the different kinds of Spanish, Cuban, Puerto Rican guitar to the dialects. There's the different accents between the different Latin countries.
Of course.
So I think there's kind of like that parallel too.
Yeah.
When you come to UWM, you're studying classical guitar. You're both graduate students. Are you studying Puerto Rican classical guitar, or are they teaching you other styles of classical guitar, and are you learning Puerto Rican music on your own, or how does this work?
Well, yeah, we study classical guitar in Puerto Rico. We have both a bachelor and the dance, Puerto Rican dance. We study the Puerto Rican, but, you know, the professors used to, like, give us one piece, but this project that we have is something that we wanted to do. And it's something that we really like to enjoy. We enjoy to do it, so we want to share this with everyone. So
yeah, well, we don't really define this, especially because this is not intended. I should have said that in the beginning. It's not intended for the classical guitar. These are all arrangements. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you ask us about Puerto Rican guitar, there is some style that is, because we have composers who composed for guitar. And then in that sense, you can say Puerto Rican classical guitar, but classical guitar in general is has so much different aspects. So we just say, when you say classical guitar, we just imagine
Beethoven or something.
Yeah, it's just something big, you know. It's just an island string guitar, and we play instrumental music, but it could be anything, really. It doesn't have to be classical in the sense of European music or before 19th century, and something like that. So when we come here to study classical guitar, so we study everything, not just Puerto Rican music.
So then what do you want to do with your degrees once you graduate?
That's so such a good question. Well, I really enjoy teaching a lot. I would love to just go and teach in some university and perform, of course. That would be like to just do the same as my mentor, my teacher, Rene Izquierdo. He teach and he performs. And because when you're teaching and you're performing, the students have something to admire, because it's so hard to teach and perform, and because you have to practice so much. Mm-hmm. And the guitar being such a difficult instrument, it's just so much. I mean, there's not enough hours in the day. So, well, you know, for that, I know that I have to keep studying. So I'm actually going to just keep going. I'm starting my DMA in Minnesota, not this year, next year. So I'm just, for now, just keep studying and eventually settle down on teaching and perform every time. I cannot stop performing. If I stop performing, then I'm not a musician.
Lose power. I'm in the same way. So I think I want to perform and one day give class in university, be a professor. But most of the time, I want to perform and make concert, give concert everywhere. And that's the main goal.
Is there a strong presence of Puerto Rican music in America?
That's a very good question. Maybe with the salsa music?
Yeah, definitely in popular music, there is a strong presence. Most people love salsa here, whoever I met.
Salsa is like South American, Cuban, a lot from everywhere, but we have a lot of amazing singers like Hector Lavoe and Frankie Ruiz and who more?
Oh, there are a million. Yeah.
Willie Colon. We have a lot of amazing singers.
We're naming the dead ones for now.
But they are super good.
Yeah, that's true.
The way that we find that people like the Puerto Ricans music is salsa. They like to dance salsa, and you know that's the only way that in my experience. Yeah.
I don't think they have a sense of what we call classical music of Puerto Rico. That would be this type of dance I'm using.
Yeah.
So is there a place in Milwaukee that you would recommend listeners to go to listen to Puerto Rican music? Or where would you go on a Friday or Saturday night to take in Puerto Rican music if you didn't want to play it?
I think Joan can add. I don't go out that much. So, but Joan, where would you go to dance?
I'm going to be very honest. The only place is a place that I used to go and dance salsa music. So I say the name of the place?
Sure.
It's Warehouse. Yes, please do. Okay. Warehouse is very famous because, you know, a lot of people used to go and dance salsa. That's the only way that I can feel like connected, because they put a lot of salsa music of Puerto Rican singers. And of course, I go and dance and, you know, I enjoy and I feel like Puerto Rican for some minutes and hours. So
where can we go and hear you perform?
To perform?
We give various concerts. We perform a lot at UWM, at the Peck School of the Arts. We usually give concerts, a couple concerts in two churches that are here on the east side. One is called St. Mark's. It's by Downer behind Cafe Honder. And then we have, we usually give concerts also in another church called Plymouth Church that is closer to campus.
Okay, can you give us one more song before we go?
Sure, that'd be great.
So what is it?
Oh, Impromptu by another Puerto Rican composer called Luis Rodriguez Miranda.
All right. Well, John and Hector, thank you so much for joining us on WWM.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Hector Gonzalez and John Ruiz are two Puerto Rican guitarists, and they study at UWM's Peck School of the Arts in the Fingerstyle Guitar Program. They're performing a UWM guitar recital Thursday evening at 7:30. It takes place at the Plymouth Church on East Hampshire Street. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next.